The slides are not very exciting anyway. So. You have the advantage at home that you have slides and we don't have slides here. But they're not very exciting, so it's not a very big advantage. Right, so we're now talking about the antecedents in Gay's career that would suggest that he was going to write the most successful play of the century. Any ideas? Are there any indications that he could write something like the Beggar's Opera before he writes the Beggar's Opera? Irritating my nose. I need to change mask. For some reason it's cut into my nose. I won't breathe. Don't worry. I'm not going to breathe. Okay, try again. I don't know if this is going to mist up less as well. Maybe. Okay, so you don't know.
No.
Right. In 1712, he wrote a play called The Mohawks. Who were the Mohawks? Or the Mohawks? Well, what is the Mohican? A Mohican, yes.
A Native American,
good. A Native North American.
Yeah.
A Mohican, where might you see references to a Mohican in Western culture? In Western culture now?
Because
of no, but where might you see a reference? Where if I asked a teenager, what are I? Sorry? No, don't talk about Pocahontas. Pocahontas was not a Mohican.
I think we are confusing.
No. If we talk about a Mohican.
Daniel Day-Lewis.
Right, Daniel Day-Lewis, yes. Il Corte de Pelo? No, less than Mohicano. Yes?
Yeah.
Yes? Right, okay. That's what a teenager would understand, probably. The first thing you mention a Mohican, they would think you're talking about the haircut. Right, well, you may think that is something that comes out of punk from the 1970s, but not. There was a situation where in this time, one group of rich aristocrats, a little bit like if you remember Henry Howard shooting stones through the windows of Protestants, breaking the windows of Protestants, rich aristocrats, a little bit like also Boris Johnson when he was young, going around attacking people, breaking things, etc., with Mohican haircuts, etc., etc., was something which happened at this time. And so, yeah, the aristocracy in Britain have behaved badly for a long time.
That story
What?
I would never have thought about the haggard Mohican.
What do you mean?
That probably they
misbehaved. Oh. Presumably it was one way of sort of making sure they were not so identified because people would see the hair and not see the whatever. I remember that most of the rest of the time they were probably wearing wigs. So you could have a Mohican haircut and then the rest of the time you have a wig and nobody has any idea who you are. But anyway. Which is, as I say, about young aristocrats behaving badly. And then in 1715 he wrote a tragic comedy called The What You Call It, which was a tragic comic pastoral farce. It is in its perception that in a class-dominated society, rich and poor are essentially alike, The What You Call It contains the seeds of what would become the Beggar's Opera. So we have this idea of the very rich, yeah, the upper class, and the lumpen proletariat, the very poor and the criminal classes, are essentially very, very similar. Who would that argument appeal to? Who would like that type of argument? Attacking the people at the top and attacking the people at the bottom. Well, no, it's attacking. This is attacking the people at the top and attacking the people at the bottom. Who would like that? Punk, good, correct. So we said punk. Punk. No, somebody on the chat in relation to the previous, somebody said punk, which is correct. The people in the middle. Yeah. This literature is more and more focused on bourgeoisie. Yeah? The London trading class, etc., etc., the people who are non-aristocratic but have money.
And so you mean by the new rich, not the trainers?
Yeah, the new rich, but they are much more of a class now. They're much more of, we could really identify them as the bourgeoisie, the capitalists, the people who earn money from trade, from shops, from factories, etc., etc. And they obviously are envious of the privileges of the aristocracy, who don't deserve their privileges, of course, really. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, they are scared of the masses of poor who are a danger at this time to people, you know, will attack people in the streets, etc., etc. So this situation of equating the top and the bottom as the problem in society is very much in the interest of this new bourgeois class, who we will talk more and more about. In 1716, Swift suggested that someone should write a Newgate pastoral, i.e. an idyllic play about the innocents suffering in Newgate prison. Completely booked up now. Okay, so the idea for the Beggar's Opera, in one sense, actually comes from Swift. And he takes up this idea. There are elements of influence from the Commedia dell'arte. Another new form that was emerging in the 1720s was pantomime. What do we understand by pantomime?
In one word,
not two minutes,
or one, two...
No. Pantomime in English refers to farcical... No, that's Spanish. That is mime, just mime. Pantomime in English refers to comic plays that are done before Christmas. For example, the Madrid Players every year do a pantomime, which in the past the king and his daughter, the king used to take his daughters to see this. They would always sneak in at the end with their bodyguards where everybody was seated. I don't suppose that now that he is the king and Elena or whoever is the heir apparent, that they can actually go to this. But in the past, they went every year on one of the days to go and see this. It's absolutely typical of British, and I think quite a lot of American society. It's one of the standard things of Christmas. I hate pantomime. But typically you get fairy tale, so Jack and the Beanstalk or Mother Goose or one of these stories. A script is written for the specific play with lots of contemporary jokes. So if they did a pantomime this year, which probably they won't because of all of this, there would be lots of comments about masks and, you know, COVID and blah, 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 blah. And, for example, I mean, a standard thing is that there is a dame who is an older woman who is always played by a man, often a man with a beard, so it's very clear that it's a man, and the young hero is a male character, like Peter Pan or that other character, but is always played by a young woman. And so there's lots of cross-dressing and all the sort of, you know, standard practice of theatre in that sort of sense. That was beginning at this time and beginning to become popular. And in 1724, a pantomime called Harlequin Shepherd was produced in London about Jack Shepherd, about the cat burglar, who is the main inspiration for Macheath. Gay wrote a ballad for this pantomime, so it's not a case of saying this idea was floating around, you know, in the atmosphere of a new historicist. He wrote one of the songs for this play. Obviously, he knew it existed, which was called The Newgate's Garland, about Shepherd's accomplice, Joseph Blake, who cut Jack Wilde's throat, who cut his throat and nearly killed him, in a law court, in fact, in 1724. So that was very topical at the time. Daniel Defoe was interested in similar themes. In 1724, he wrote A Life of John Shepherd, probably. It's an anonymous life of John Shepherd, but it's almost certainly written by... A Life of Jonathan Wilde. I'm reading it wrong. I'll start again. In 1724, he wrote A Life of John Shepherd. In 1725, he probably wrote A Life of Jonathan Wilde. The Life of Jonathan Wilde was published anonymously, that's why it's probably. Basically, all of this time, the newspapers were full of this sort of stories of the scandals and the corruption that was going on. What is very important at this time is what's called the Newgate Calendar. The Newgate Calendar is something which was a way, above all, for the chaplain of Newgate Prison to earn a bit of extra money. He would hear confession from prisoners and collect the stories of what they said, and embellish the stories a little bit, make them more interesting if possible, and make them morally interesting. And these stories would be published once a year as the Newgate Calendar. And so the idea of true crime and a little bit like sort of morning television, you have the Criminal Passive Effective, all these types of documentaries. Okay. It's that sort of sensationalist culture. And if you like, it's also related to CSI and Law and Order and all of these hundreds of programs about crime and justice, etc., etc. But there is also a heavy dose of Chaucer here. Gay is a cultured man, and as any cultured man in this time, he knew his Chaucer. Chaucer is somebody who has nobody really, I don't think, I can't really think of anybody who would possibly be writing professionally in England, in Britain, and not have read some Chaucer. I mean, even if it's just at school, but I'm sure that J.K. Rowling will have read the Canterbury Tales. I wouldn't risk a finger, but I would put money on the fact that J.K. Rowling has read some of the Canterbury Tales. Chaucer is a necessary part of the culture for anybody who wants to be considered, in some sense, refined or cultivated. But in fact, Gay is buried in Westminster Abbey next to Chaucer. All of the famous people are buried together. Like Chaucer's pilgrims, all of the characters in The Beggar's Opera are straining against the social conventions of what is expected of them. People may be highwaymen, but they want to be considered gentlemen. Somebody may be just a prison guard or a prison janitor or whatever, but he wants to be a businessman, etc., etc. The prostitutes want to be considered to be ladies. Everybody is trying to break out of a socially constricted role in a way that is very similar to Chaucer. Macheath is an outsider who breaks an unspoken code of conduct when he attempts to marry and abandon his criminal lifestyle. Macheath is okay if he's a criminal, but if he wants to stop being a criminal and become a gentleman, that's not okay. And that's when you have to punish him, ironically, of course. He is guilty of stealing, gambling, beating, robbing travellers, and cheating at cards and dice, but these offences are seldom mentioned as faults in Macheath. his fault, is trying to, is marrying Polly, Polly Peachum. Macheath is a highwayman who sees himself as an aristocrat. Peachum and Lockett are thief taker and jailer who see themselves as merchants. The characters are basically amoral rather than immoral. In 1713, Gay wrote a play, The Wife of Bath, based obviously on Chaucer's character of The Wife of Bath. So again, we know that he knew Chaucer's not floating around in the atmosphere. And in that sense, it's quite possible that this play could have had some influence on Moll Flanders. That is, Moll Flanders, a woman who gets serially married, and above all, the wife of Bath seems to have some way of not having children. We don't know what that is, whether that is abortion, whether that's some type of contraception or whatever. And of course, the one thing that we can undeniably say about Moll Flanders is she does not have a maternal instinct. I think we can agree on that. Okay. Where's this print? For some reason, my nose is not happy. Polly admires the gentle towns ladies and wants to become one. The play suggests that Polly's dichotomy between ladies and common women is a false one. Okay? Which, of course, is part of the big joke in Moll Flanders. Because Moll Flanders confuses the prostitute with being a lady, and that when she's 7 or 8, that's when she says, I want to be that. And I want to be that, thinking she's talking about a lady, but of course, what she's actually talking about is a prostitute. And so in the process, she becomes, if you like, both things at different moments in her life. Likewise, Lucy dreams of Macheath making her an honest woman. So this idea of, you know, an honest woman, blah, 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 in a situation where you have a serial philanderer. Part of the joke, of course, for Polly and Lucy and everybody else is that they have this young woman's romantic idea of love when Macheath is quite clearly, I mean, he may be all sorts of things, he may be a victim in all sorts of ways, but quite clearly he is a cad in the sense that he's a womanizer, he is somebody who is disloyal in relationships. Yeah, he may be a victim more than anything else in terms of that being his criminal activities, but in relation to women, he is quite clearly a cad. All the characters take themselves seriously, even though their words are comical. So again, we have this situation where, as with Chaucer's characters, the people are not talking, they're not talking funny. Yeah? They think that they're convincing Chaucer's character of what is their truth that they have tried to construct. The reality, of course, is that if we have a satirical sensibility, can read between the lines and see how there is a contradiction, see the hypocrisy, etc. So there's quite a lot learned from Chaucer. At the same time, we can also point to Jacobean roots of this opera. Sorry, yes, well, this play, this musical. So while, of course, the main topic, one of the main topics here is to attack the temporary fashion or the temporary craze of opera, of Italian opera, of course, plays that are so simple that you can understand them in a language that you don't understand a single word. So we're not, you know, I mean, we could criticize the Beggar's Opera for having rather a simple storyline. The storyline of operas is even more simple. I mean, it's ridiculously simple because you don't have to understand it. Mm-hmm. So, for example, there is a scene with dancing prisoners in the third act. Again, you know, the idea of prisoners dancing around in chains, etc. Canterton Chronicle now, could be something out of a cartoon now, but when you're used to seeing people who are malnourished wandering around, you know, in the streets being transported one side or another in chains, it's pretty dark humour again. That seems to echo the dancing madmen, of course. Lunatic asylums in the Jacobean period were basically prisons. The Changeling. Have you seen The Changeling? There is a film. There's a film version of it, which is quite good. One of the actors is, in fact, Ian Dury. Do you know who Ian Dury is? Ian Dury? No? He was an important figure in British punk. Probably one or two of his songs you would be able to identify. He was somebody who had polio as a child, so he always walked with a stick. He's very, very good in this play. And it's one of the few cases where you can see a Jacobean play, which is not, you know, from Shakespeare always, which is a revenge tragedy. It's interesting because it's set in Alicante. So it's set in Spain. It's a sort of typical bloody, horrible revenge tragedy, but quite interesting at the same time. And in that, there is this dance scene set in a prison. And so that could be compared to this prisoner's dance here. There are quotations and references to Shakespeare throughout the Beggar's Opera. I haven't actually made a list of them, but there are. And finally, there is a comparison at one point in Act 1, Scene 5, where young women are compared to coins. Can you think of a possible connection? Coins which change hands, you know, so a coin will go from one person to another, just as a young woman will go from one person to another. But it's a similar comparison, it's a similar example of reification, again, as what we have in Volpone. Volpone, there is a scene done by the eunuch and the hermaphrodite and the dwarf. There's like a little skit, and they sing a song about the soul being like a coin. So they talk about a soul which goes from the donkey to a Greek philosopher, and then, you know, from one person to another, study off with an animal, and then go from one person to another. And it's very similar to a coin going from one person's pocket to another person's pocket. Again, very much the idea of reification. And Volpone is, of course, part of the satirical tradition, which this play is also in. Why were there so few plays being written at the beginning of the 18th century? I mean, this is the most successful play written in the 18th century. The only possible competitors are from the 1770s, The Rivals and She Stoops to Conquer by Oliver Goldsmith. Sorry, no. She Stoops to Conquer by Oliver Goldsmith, The Rivals, and School for Scandal by Sheridan. There's a little moment, a little flash of great theatre in Britain in the 1770s. It's really weird because you have great theatre during Shakespeare's lifetime and just after him, basically nothing until the Beggar's Opera, all on its own. Nothing important is being done around this time. The 1770s, three excellent plays, nothing until Oscar Wilde, really, and some of Oscar Wilde, I mean, the earlier plays by Oscar Wilde, like Lady Windermere's Fan, etc., or The Ideal Husband, or A Woman of No Importance, are performed now because they're Oscar Wilde. But the only great, great play by Oscar Wilde is The Importance of Being Earnest, which is a fantastic play.
Yeah.
But the earlier plays by him are not that wonderful, really. And then, of course, you have after that, you have George Bernard Shaw, and you have the modern theatre of the 20th century, which is perfectly valid. there's this weird situation in English theatre where you get this boom of activity, and the rest of the time people are writing plays, but they're rubbish because nobody's interested. So it's a little bit strange. The interesting thing again about the whole what happens with Oscar Wilde is that he's very, very much taking up the tradition that was being produced in the 1770s by Sheridan and Goldsmith. So despite the fact there's a 120 years gap, he's very much taking up where they left off. So weird things, but these things happen. So
maybe because of political situation, because there are
the Beggar's Opera was produced and was hugely successful, so there was the possibility.
But the Vienna one was produced at the theaters to open again, because I think two theaters were recently opened after a year of the censorship, and all the theaters were shut down.
But the nature of censorship is slightly different from what you're saying. The question is, you have a choice. You can say, I'm going to produce a well-known play by Johnson, or maybe Dryden, or Shakespeare, or whatever, and maybe change it a bit. Put in a dance, put in some clowns or whatever. Make it more up-to-date, more interesting for people today. And I know that play is allowed because it's passed the censors already. However, if I write a new play, or I get somebody to write a new play, I'm going to have to pay that person, and then we have to see if the censors accept it. If the censors say no, unlucky. You just lose your money. And that is another thing that is related to that, and also influencing that, is that the main interest at the time was in mise-en-scène, the puesta en escena. We say it in French for some reason, I don't know why. But they're much more interested in how you can, make people fly through the air and have trapdoors, and how you actually go about producing the play than creating new comedy. So again, one of the reasons why this is so hugely successful is because it's so rough. But in this case, it's so refreshing to have somebody actually, saying something relevant rather than just, another Hamlet, which is what people were suffering a lot at the time. And so that's sort of why all of that was going on. It's important to realise that Gay's relationship with the opera is very ambivalent. He wrote some librettos, he worked in the opera, but at the same time, his attitude, I think, was above all this obsession about Italian opera, which, you can all Italian opera, you don't understand what's going on, you don't understand the action, you don't understand what they're saying. So that's his sort of situation here. It's not that he's against opera in itself, and he can no doubt recognize that his contemporaries like Handel are geniuses. But a lot of people are spending huge amounts of money, because it's very expensive to put on an opera and very expensive to go to it, when they're pretty much Philistines, because they don't really know what's happening. They're just doing it because it's fashionable. He wrote the libretto to Handel's short pastoral opera, Acis and Galatae, and he was writing an opera seria when he died. He was actually in the process of writing his own opera. So it's not a situation where he's just rejecting opera completely, he has a problem with this situation. And of course, the fight scene between Lucy and Polly is based on this famous cat fight there was between these two, the two prima donnas, which was the talk of the town. So the idea of this satire is very much just to turn everything upside down. If you make every element of society, you put it topsy-turvy, as well as in English, then you can see what the result is, and of course that will be a comment on both what is, on both sides of what is turned upside down. So, I guess I mentioned before, the key word is reification. Things are treated like people, and more importantly, people are treated like things. Everything and everyone has a price. Prisons are likened to hotels, and I think I mentioned how the press yard cell in Newgate Prison was offered, which had light and fresh air and a nice view, was literally the most expensive rooms in London. Law enforcers are criminals, as we've seen. Prostitutes behave like ladies. And friendship is dictated by self-interest. And of course, for the first time ever, perhaps in the history of the world, you have a situation where if you have somehow achieved some sort of education and you can get hold of the right clothes, because for the first time we have a sort of a metropolis, we have a big city, we have this city which is the centre of the world, relatively briefly, but it is the centre of the world. Anonymity exists. In all previous societies, somebody walks into your shop, and they're either a stranger, which is a strange occurrence, or they're Mrs. Jenkins, who you've known all your life. Yeah? But most of the time in shops, in towns and villages, you know all of your customers. You've grown up with them, in bars, in coffee shops, in whatever. For the first time, you have a city which is big enough where most of the people who you interact with are complete strangers. So for the first time, you have the possibility for somebody who is completely common, like Moll Flanders, but has had enough of an education in the Colchester home, to, when she can get hold of the clothes, to pass herself off as a lady. And she does it convincingly enough to be able to use that for her advantage. So then we have for the first time a society where you can't just imagine that somebody who speaks in a certain way wears certain clothes. Of course, the sartorial laws that were around at the time of Shakespeare, which said that a commoner could not wear this and a poor person could not wear this, those have lapsed now. So it is incredibly difficult to know who is really a gentleman and who isn't. Remember, we're talking about, under lots of cases, gentlemen, young noblemen who are drunks, who are hooligans, who get Mohican haircuts, a lot of these people now going on the grand tour. And they have to have what's called a bear keeper, who is an older man who accompanies them to get them out of prison and to extract them from brothels and to take them home when they're drunk, etc., etc. This is not civilized aristocracy. The idea, a little bit like now, is to get these things out of their system in continental Europe so they don't behave like that in England. So, generally speaking, there's a sort of idea that, for example, with football fans, less so now in the past, I think Britain has improved the situation and improved its reputation in this sense. But certainly in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, there was a situation of, people went wild when they were brought. They still do in Magaluf. People behave in Magaluf. Young people behave in Magaluf. A lot of them are university students, for God's sake, in a way that they would never behave in Britain. Now, part of the problem is Spanish in terms of cheap alcohol, but part of the problem is the idea that what happens in Magaluf stays in Magaluf, and that's not nice to you. It's very embarrassing for the rest of us, but that's what there is. And it has to be said that I know that British governments in the past have said, and the embassy has said to the Spanish authorities, be as hard on them as you like. There's not a situation where the British government is trying to get people off leniently. They want these people who behave badly and want to be punished. But it still happens. But there is, there is a double game, if you like, because there's the neighbours and everybody complaining. But of course, that brings an awful lot of money into places like Malibu. And you can't, you know, if you completely clean up on it, the city is going to be much poorer. So, you know, it's a difficult game, and it's unfortunate, shall we say. But anyway, marriage, of course, is something which is particularly ridiculed in this play. Romantic love is made ludicrous because Polly, Lucy, etc. fall head over heels in love with an obvious cad, as I mentioned. Moreover, even wanting to marry for love is described as the result of a bad upbringing. Of course, wanting, you know, normally we would understand the idea of sexual relations, maybe before marriage, or in an earlier society, that would have been a problem, etc., etc. But here, getting married for love is bad upbringing. So again, it's the society the wrong way around, because you should be getting married for money. Now, of course, that is exactly what the aristocracy is doing, because aristocracy is getting married for money. Generally speaking, I think where people get married, when amongst the lumpen proletariat, amongst the poor, is probably because somebody's pregnant and they, you know, their family forces them, etc., etc. But the aristocracy are doing it for coin, for money, and so it's not that far from the truth. And social advancement, of course. And again, we have this argument from Polly's mother and from Mr. Peacham, that marriage, instead of being a reason for monogamous charity, offers respectability as a camouflage under which wives can satisfy their sexual whims. So instead of saying, you know, once you're married, once you're a wife, you have to be chaste, once you're married, once you're a wife, you can do what you like, because the fact that you're a wife covers your reputation. Again, everything upside down, if you like. To some extent, for everybody in the play, the noose is their future. Yeah, like, everyone's going to get executed eventually. Lockham, Peacham, everybody. And so you have this idea of living for today. Peacham does not betray his employees out of cruelty, but simply as a matter of accounting. Yeah. If somebody is worth more, betraying them to the authorities, than what they're bringing in from their criminal activities, the logic, economic logic again, like in the Modest Proposal, says that you betray them. They may have been loyal for 10 years. The accounts are the accounts. Yeah? So again, reification. This, which is comparable to The Modest Proposal. So rogues come to grief because they are betrayed for money, not because they are overtaken by justice. It's not because anybody catches you that you are punished, but because you are betrayed for money. Justice is quite clearly for sale. And the idea of the Peacham Locket arrangement is meant to mirror the closed circle of government and lawmaking in 18th century Britain. Yeah. The people who are breaking the law most seriously are the people who are the same class of people who are in charge of making the law. The only unbending law is the natural law of selfishness. So we will see in a number of contexts at this time the growing idea of capitalism as self-interest, and really the origins to some extent of Darwinism, and to some extent social Darwinism. We'll see that basically all of the ingredients for Darwin's conclusions, for Darwin's theory, exist at this time in the periodical essays. Very soon we will see, I think next week we will see the periodical essays. And those sorts of ideas are very much to the fore. there is this idea that they're very much competing ideas, ideas from people like Hobbes, that human beings are horrible, basically, and self-interested, and the ideas from people like Shaftesbury, the Duke of Shaftesbury, that people are basically good and socially aware and altruistic, etc., etc. And the importance of these two ideas, the idea of empathy versus the idea of self-interest, fluctuate through society. And in fact, you can draw a history of Britain, a history of the world, in terms of this changing importance. A wonderful example of this changing, the change around with this, is in the from the 1780s onwards, you have this massive campaign of empathy to end first the slave trade and then slavery itself. And this is vastly against the economic interests of the country. But a small group of people first decide that any economic interest cannot justify this. And they start, for example, distributing leaflets with slaves telling their stories, telling about what happens when they cross the Atlantic. They then bring slaves, ex-slaves from plantations from America, from the Caribbean, and they have exhibits and they show people where they've been beaten, etc., etc., etc. And there's this wave of empathy which results in 1804 in the end of the slave trade, and then in 1830, more or less, in the abolition of slavery. And Britain actually dedicates a whole fleet to ensuring that the slave trade stops. And there's something like 10,000 British sailors die in the 19th century, ensuring that the slave trade will not continue. So there is quite a serious attempt to make good the evil crime against humanity of the slave trade in the Victorian period. Victorians were not as bad as people think, in lots of ways. Okay, well, there's a bit more there, and we will come to that. I will post the notes also on the for today's tutorial on the forum, because there are some things which are new which were not in the tutorial notes. Okay, well, apparently we have to go. So sorry about the short class. I hope the internet manages to solve their technical problems for next week. Next week is... Has anybody looked at Inteca?
Yeah.
I think it's the... either way, there's nothing I can do about it. I think it's the periodical essays next week. Okay? Which are very interesting. So, there you go. Okay. Right, see you then. Be good.